Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Blackfeet writer Stephen Graham Jones is out with another installment of his Indian Lake series of books. The Angel of Indian Lake is the last of the trilogy, and that keeps readers on the edge of their seats wondering how much more can the main character take. Jones knows his way around the suspenseful horror genre. He's been at it for years, and now he is moving on from his Proof Rock, Idaho setting that is so menacing for its inhabitants. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Kalispell tribe is working with several agencies to investigate whether bull trout can be introduced into a northeast Washington lake. Steve Jackson reports from Spokane.
The Kalispell tribe, along with the U.S. and Washington Departments of Fish and Wildlife, are teaming up on a bull trout recovery plan that targets Sullivan Lake. That's located a few miles from Medellin Falls in Ponderay County. The fish is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Tribal officials say it's present in small numbers downstream of Albany Falls Dam, but there's no historic record of it living in Sullivan Lake. Jason Connor with the Tribal Fisheries Department says he hopes to gather eggs, juvenile, and adult fish from tributaries in Idaho and transplant them to the lake.
The overall goal is a self-sustaining population, and then beyond that, we would like to see a harvestable surplus in the lake. We'd like to have Kalispell tribal members have the opportunity to once again harvest bull trout in the lower Ponderay.
Connor says all members of the public will be able to catch and keep bull trout if the population reaches sustainable levels. He says the lake is an ideal location because lake trout, the main predator of bull trout, are not present in Sullivan Lake. He says the bull trout introduction would not result in any changes to fishing, boating, or camping, although some restrictions could be implemented in adjacent Harvey Creek during spawning season. You can find out more and leave a comment on the plan on the Washington Fish and Wildlife website. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
U.S. Representative Harriet Hageman of Wyoming spoke in favor of a bill recently that would bar transgender athletes from competing in the Olympics. LGBTQ advocates say it's discriminatory and worry about the impact of the legislation on trans people, including those living on the Wind River Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements has more.
In a combative committee hearing on Capitol Hill, Hageman carried the legislation, which passed. She says it's necessary to protect the privacy of cisgender women from trans women who might want to compete in the Olympic Games alongside them.
It is about protecting women and girls in women and girls athletics. That is all.
Leha Spoonhunter describes themselves as a Two-Spirit Wyomingite and a member of the Eastern Shoshone tribe.
This legislation is another piece of harmful and discriminatory legislation that is targeted in a specific community, and that, you know, we have bigger issues that we need to address.
Spoonhunter says any enforcement of the ban by the government would involve violating the personal safety and rights of trans people. Other lawmakers pointed to the fact that the bill addresses what they say is a non-issue. Hageman says she hopes the bill will pass Congress in time for the 2024 Summer Olympics. I'm Chris Clements.
U.S. California Representatives Jared Huffman and Adam Schiff recently introduced legislation to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. The Tribal Community Protection Act encourages record sharing between tribal and state and local law enforcement. According to the lawmakers, complicated jurisdictional overlaps between federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies contribute to the problem. They say the bill aims to bridge the gap by promoting cooperation and information sharing. Several national Native organizations support the legislation, including the National Congress of American Indians and the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. The legislation is co-sponsored by seven representatives from across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Lakota made indigenous first medicines and eco-friendly personal care products are small batch prepared in the Lakota traditions using sustainably harvested natural and organic ingredients, and all can be found at lakotamade.com who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling, your National Humanities Medal-awarded radio show and podcast. If you're a fan of slasher movies, then you might already be a fan of the Indian Lake Trilogy by Blackfeet author Stephen Graham Jones. The Angel of Indian Lake just came out and is the last novel in the series. Jones brings back main character Jade Daniels. She is a slasher movie fan and is subjected to both new and familiar evils that parallel the genre she loves. There are human and supernatural threats in her hometown of Proof Rock, Idaho. Stephen Graham Jones joins us today. He's a New York Times bestselling author who also penned The Only Good Indians, the Earth Divers graphic novel series, and Night of the Mannequins, among a dozen other books. Please join our discussion today. Are you a fan of Stephen Graham Jones or his final girl protagonist, Jade Daniels? Let's talk at 1-800-996-2848. That number is also 1-800-99-NATIVE, and we've got the phone lines open right now. So if you get your calls in, we'll get your questions and comments on the air. With that, let's go ahead and meet our guest today, Stephen Graham Jones. He is an author and an English professor at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and he is Blackfeet. Hello, Stephen. It is so great to have you on the show today.
Man, thank you for that introduction. I'm thrilled to be here talking with you.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show. I got the book here. You know, we put this show together, and I hadn't had a chance to read the book, so I ran out Friday afternoon, got the book, and read it over the weekend, and I was really gripped. Just so much to talk about. Such a just really, really moving novel. But before we get into the conversation, let's talk about this term final girl. What exactly is a final girl? We mentioned it there on the intro, and it's a familiar trope in slasher movies, but tell our listeners a little bit more.
The final girl is the one who survives the night, the weekend, the reunion, whatever event has drawn a slasher in to, you know, do its thing with a machete or a pickaxe or whatever. The final girl runs and runs and screams and trips and falls, and finally she gets tired of that. She turns around and she faces that bully down. And for me, the final girl is the antidote to the cycle of violence that the slasher wants to spill out on the world, but she puts a cap on it. She's the only thing that can stop the slasher.
In just about every slasher film or book, you've got to have that one hero that makes it, right? You can't kill everybody off, and she's that person.
Yeah. She is, yeah, yeah. She, against all odds, because she doesn't have the strength. And I say she, the final girl can sometimes be male as well, but it's typically a woman. She, against all odds, finds the reserves of strength and kind of grit to make it through. It's usually she doesn't make it through unharmed. There's generally some scarring, some injuries, and some, of course, psychological and emotional trauma. And also, she's probably lost all her friends, her pets, her families, her teachers, and everything. So there's a whole lot of loss involved, but she pushes through. And I really like that quality about final girls, that they insist upon the importance and the value of their own lives, and they try to protect everyone they can along the way.
I do too. And one thing that you address in the novel, and I think is really important, like so many times you'll go see thrasher movies or slasher movies, and it's like you just kind of wonder, well, what happens to these people after? They must be so emotionally traumatized. Like they just kind of walk off and they, like, you know, go off hand in hand, whatever. It's like everything's done. But you address that, like what kind of emotional impact it would be on a person to deal with that level of trauma and just complete disruption in your life. So there's that realistic element to it. So essentially we see Jade grow throughout this novel then and in the series as well, right?
We do. In My Heart is a Chainsaw, the first installment, she thought her life had a whole lot of injustice and unfairness in it, and it did. She was an outcast among her family, her school, her community. Just she didn't belong anywhere, and she had a lot of grievances with the world. And slashers rise to insist upon fairness. It's a brutal sort of fairness, but slashers are generally getting revenge or payback for some prank or crime that was committed against them. And so Jade, as a high schooler, longed and prayed for a slasher to come to her hometown of Proof Rock, Idaho, and visit some of that justice upon people. However, once a slasher shows up, she realized this is not what she wanted at all. It's hard to survive a slasher. People you love end up getting hurt. And so, in Don't Fear the Reaper, she has grown up 4 years, and she's no longer the high school, the angry high school girl she was. She's still angry, but she's trying to put her fascination with slashers behind her. However, she has to fight another one. Then in Angel of Indian Lake, she has matured three more years after that, and another slasher is showing up, and you know she doesn't want to get pulled back in, but she keeps getting pulled back in. It's like she made one really good wish when she was 17, and now she's having to deal with the fallout of that wish over and over.
Well, it really makes one think of that old saying, be careful what you wish for, because it might come true. Mm-hmm. And in this case, and she harbors an enormous amount of guilt throughout the book of, you know, being that impetus that's created all this violence and all this chaos. And what I really admire about your writing, Stephen, is the character of Jade. I mean, it's not just like these little references here and there to like horror movies and the genre. It's just this, they're completely worked into the whole book. Like just throughout the book, she has these little visions, she has these reflections. And you're like an authority on slasher movies from like all the way through like mm-hmm. the 1960s. Like there's so many little references, and a lot of them I caught because I'm a fan of slasher films and books, and I've read a fair number over the years. But some of them I had to Google, and then some of them I just like, wow, like how does he remember that old movie, or how does he remember that old story? But it was really cool the way you worked it all in. And part of me is like, you know, Jade's over here. She's in this really violent situation. You know, somebody's coming at her with a chainsaw or an axe. And her first thought is like, well, geez, this kind of reminds me of like this one slasher movie from such and such a date. And I'm like, wow, mm-hmm. like she really, I don't know if I'd be thinking about movie quotes and things like that if I was under the gun like that. But the other thing too, you write from a female perspective, which I think is super, super challenging to do. And I'm curious, what mm-hmm. kind of feedback are you getting from female readers? Are they happy with the viewpoint that you share?
As near as I can tell, they think Jade is real, you know, and that's all I can really ask for, is that they don't feel like she's fake. And that to me is all, that's my biggest wish, I guess, is to make Jade real. But yeah, I am a dude writing a woman, and how can I do that, you know? And the answer is with help, which is to say, I give the early drafts of these novels to women readers, and I think it's really unfair to ever ask someone, is this good representation? Is this accurate representation? Because that's basically saying, can you give me license to do this? And that puts a lot of pressure on that person. And I would hopefully never ask anyone for that. However, I can ask them, where am I being stupid? Where is my ignorance showing? And they can tell me here, 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 and also here, a lot of places. And then I take their advice and their suggestions and I incorporate it. And that is a big part of how Jade gets real on the page. However, when I was first writing Jade back in 2018, I guess, I had my daughter to watch. My daughter was 17 at the time, the same age Jade was then. So that was extremely helpful for me.
Is your daughter a slasher film fan too?
She is. She loves it all.
Well, there were so many references. I mean, there's slasher films, but then other movies. I mean, there was a reference to The Breakfast Club. I caught a Harry Potter reference. And then, of course, some of these classic slasher films that a lot of us grew up with, like Friday the 13th and Halloween. But of all those different slasher films and stories that you drew from, which ones do you think kind of embodied the most of the story there in The Angel of Indian Lake and the whole series even?
You know, Jade would cite Scream as one of the seminal texts, like a big part of the canon as far as slashers are concerned. And at Nightmare on Elm Street is very important to her because her father became kind of like a figuration of Freddy Krueger. So Freddy Krueger kind of haunts her in a sense. And she really reveres Jason Voorhees' mother from Friday the 13th, Pamela Voorhees, who fought and killed for her son, or for the memory of her son, or for the injustice visited upon her son. And Jade I said that she longed for justice and fairness, but she also really wants to have a mother who will fight for her. And she sees that mother in Pamela Voorhees, and that means a whole lot to her.
Now the book does, it deals with some really graphic scenes. It's brutally violent in many ways. What do you think the main message? What were you going for when you wrote the book in the series? What do you really want readers to take away from this?
You know, I'm totally satisfied if even like one 12-year-old girl gets hold of this book, this series, this trilogy, and realizes or feels or suspects that they could be a final girl, you know, because from all the iterations of final girls we've seen since probably 74, I guess, with Black Christmas or maybe Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right around there is when the final girl started to really congeal, I feel like, as a character type. She has become more and more of a athlete, scholar, supermodel, Sunday school expert, like everything good you can be. The final girl embodies that. But I think the initial like purpose or use of the final girl is to be a space, a model we can step into and feel empowered to push back against the bullies in our lives, be that people on a playground or a bad boss or a spouse or whatever it is. We all have people in our lives trying to exert power over us. And we need to be able to push back against them. And final girls give us instructions of how to do that, how to say that we are important, we matter more than you having your power over us. But when you put that final girl on a higher and higher and higher pedestal.
Stephen, I'm sorry, we're going to have to take a short break and we'll be right back, listeners. The Great Alaska Earthquake is etched in the minds of those who witnessed it. At the same time, it is a monumental moment for earthquake research and preparedness. We'll hear about the strongest earthquake in North America 60 years later on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are talking with Blackfeet author Stephen Graham Jones today about The Angel of Indian Lake, the last in the Indian Lake book trilogy. If you have comments or questions for Jones about his horror series, give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. And Stephen, I'm sorry we had to come to a quick break there, but you were talking about your vision of the final girl and how you really hope readers will be inspired by understanding what that means to be a final girl, that heroine. Please finish your thoughts.
Yeah, like if we put the final girl, like all these movies since the early 70s have been putting her on a higher and higher pedestal. And if the final girl is supposed to be a model for us of how we can resist the bullies in our lives, But she's on a pedestal that's so high that we can no longer inhabit that space, and I think she's lost her effectiveness. And so with Jay Daniels, I wanted to propose somebody who doesn't see herself as matching up. She's not a super athlete. She's not a scholar, and she doesn't bottle feed kittens, and she doesn't fit the traditional characteristics of a final girl. Yet when the chips are down, she's the only one there, and she has to either fight or die. And she finds that she has more inside her than she expects. And so what I want to leave the reader with in this trilogy, I want them to know that it's not about what's on the outside that makes the final girl. It's what's on the inside. It's what kind of heart you've got.
She's very relatable, Jay Daniels. And let's talk more about her Native American identity. She's Blackfeet like you, but she doesn't live, she lives in Idaho. She lives in a kind of a non-native, kind of semi-rural, semi-urban setting. Tell us more about how you designed her from that perspective, being a Native woman living kind of, you know, away from her homelands.
Yeah, well, you know, I did The Unlinked Indians, what was it, the year before My Heart is a Chainsaw, before I introduced Jay Daniels to the world. And The Unlinked Indians is set on the Blackfeet Reservation, and it's really invested in the community, the culture, the traditions and everything. I was really nervous that if I did another book in keeping with that, that I was going to be kind of whispering to people that the only real Indian stories happen on the reservations. So that's why I moved Jay to Idaho and cut off any possible connections she could have to her culture. The only connection she would have is her father, but there's so much friction between them that she would never accept any kind of conduit he provided to the culture. And what I wanted to say, I guess, is that being Native isn't about whether you can speak the language. It isn't about whether you know all the history. It's just like I was saying about a final girl. It's about who you are inside, you know? And I think the urban Indian experience is just as real as if you live on the reservation. I'm terrified of any system which kind of suggests a sort of in club, like a little castle on the mountain. You can only get in if the people at the gate say you can get in. That really scares me, and I would hopefully never be part of anything like that. And so I wanted to propose Jade, who is not in that castle. She's not up on the hill, but she's just as Indian as anybody, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I read a quote in an interview you did, and you said that there's not a single American Indian story that, as Native people, you know, we are not a monolith. And I think your book's really refreshing because it's, you know, it's there. Those elements are there, but there's so much more to it than just the fact that she's Native. Stephen, when you started the story of Jay Daniels and the story of Proof Rock, did you know you were going to make it into a trilogy?
I had no idea. No, I initially had everyone in the story dead at the end of My Heart is a Chainsaw. But my editor, Joe Monte at Saga, he kept asking me, what if not everybody died? And I kept telling him, they're built to die. You know, what are you talking about? But turns out he was right. I gave it a shot, and it opened the book up into a trilogy. So no, I never planned for this to spool out into three books. It only spooled out into three books when he had me keep Jade and a couple other people alive.
What did you learn about yourself from the writing process of a trilogy?
I learned kind of, I mean, I don't want to say I'm an expert on trilogies, but I learned a little bit about the internal dynamics, like the engine that drives them. You've got to come up with a conflict that is not necessarily tied to the dramatic line of each installment. So you've got a little dramatic line, a problem in all three novels, all three installments, and those three installments have to tie off, but you also have to have an overarching narrative, a longer conflict that can be solved, and then in its solution can allow the character to finally develop and grow. That was really fun to figure out, and it was really difficult to figure out, and I'm completely thrilled that I was able to play in that space. However, I'm probably not doing it again anytime soon.
Well, I wanted to ask you that because now, okay, it's wrapped up, The Angel of Indian Lake. But when the book ends, I mean, there's a little bit of a door there that's open. So I'm wondering, is there any chance in the future that you might revisit Jay Daniels in Proof Rock?
I did accidentally the other day. I was talking to a crowd in Tulsa, I guess, and I kind of thought of a little short story that could happen in this world. I don't know if I'll ever write it, but my plan right now is to look away from Jay Daniels because I think she has, you know, earned her retirement from fighting against masked people with machetes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. She definitely needs a break. And Stephen, one time I was reading an interview from a publisher, and that publisher said that they can tell in one page whether or not a fiction writer has the imagination to write good fiction. Just one page, they can just tell if they've got that. And I was just overwhelmed by and when I read your book, I just kept thinking of that, because your imagination, like just the way Jay Daniels, just these predicaments she gets in, these plots and subplots, and then just your level of detail, like there's this every chapter just about there are these and I'm not going to give too much away in terms of spoilers, but there's these investigative reports, and they're just like so detailed. I mean, it just seems like exactly like what an investigator would write. Where does that come from? Where do you get this kind of imagination to create these worlds where there's just all these people with that are so relatable, but at the same time, just so like over the top with this like slasher type fantasy world?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be proud of this, but I think it's just me hiding from the world, you know, like, I don't want to mow the lawn. I don't want to clean the gutters. I don't want to have to work on my truck because that's all going to go south anyways. I'm going to mess it up. But here at the keyboard, I can hide from the swirling madness I see out there. Like, I can't make sense of politics, of why we're doing what we do to the environment, any of that. It just doesn't really click for me. But on the page, for 25 pages at a time, for 400 pages at a time, I can make things make sense. I can pull a lever here and 200 pages later a light bulb comes on, and that is a system, and I can believe in it, and it feels real to me. And I love hanging out with these characters. I don't even think of them as characters, I think of them as people. And I love to put them in these operatic situations where it's like always verging on leaning over the line into melodrama. Everything is loud, the stakes are life and death, and it's just, it is a fun place to be. To me, writing and kind of moving in fictional spaces and story spaces, it's recess, it's playtime. And who doesn't want to go to recess, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And the whole horror genre, you wrote the introduction for Never Whistle at Night, an indigenous dark fiction anthology. And we featured that on our show last year. And are you seeing a trend here with other Native writers and just a growth of the horror genre in general?
I definitely am. Yeah, there's so many of us doing it right now, specifically horror. I mean, there's people playing in science fiction and fantasy as well, but it seems like horror is getting the bulk of our ink, if that makes sense. And, you know, it seems to me that, I mean, number one, I'm thrilled that we are now broaching into genre spaces, because for so long, academics, which I don't mean to say anything bad about academics, but just because of the way things kind of developed, they became the gatekeepers of American Indian Lit that made it to the shelf. Like, if a book found traction in the classroom over a few semesters, then it would maybe go wider and catch on and become a template for other books. And those books would resemble the first books. And you got kind of the snowball getting bigger and bigger. But in the last 5-6 years, that snowball has broken apart and left all of us standing here. And we're now playing in the genres that we actually want to play in. We're having fun, and we're not having to talk about the politics of identity or repatriation. I'm not saying any of that stuff is bad to talk about. It's wonderful to talk about, especially sovereignty. However, we no longer are having to write in order to fit the tools that the critical establishment has to dissect our work. We're writing what we want to write, and so the critical establishment is hopefully having to cobble together different tools to look at our stuff. And it's wonderful, because I think if we didn't change and keep changing, then things would freeze and die. And I want there to be more and more stories, more and more books.
Yeah, I do too. And I've heard other Native authors say the same, that we just need, you know, everybody writing stories and just different types mm-hmm. of stories and taking different viewpoints and just having those conversations. And even if they don't always align, we just need that richness, right? We need that variety. Yep. And the horror genre is just, it's so intriguing in so many ways. And as a kid, you know, I grew up with a lot of that stuff. And one of the references you make is to Friday the 13th and how it was released on May 9th of 1980. And that's actually it's her dad's birthday. And I just couldn't mm-hmm. help thinking about that because I remember my sister turned 18 in the spring of 1980 in May. Mm-hmm. And she was finally old enough to take me to R-rated movies because I was like 12 years old, you know? So that whole summer of 1980, we went to see Friday the 13th and like a bunch of other horror movies. I could finally see her. She could take me. We didn't have to ask permission from my mom or anything. Yeah. So I think we're pretty close in age because a lot of those references were just really similar.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, go ahead.
No, go on. I'm sorry.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about just that whole process of writing gore. Cause you know, I mean, some people are just kind of turned off by slashers or kind of turned off by the mm-hmm. gore and they just think, oh geez, you know, this just isn't really what I want to read or mm-hmm. it's not really healthy to think like this. And what's your thought on that in terms of the writing process and just when you create stories like this that are brutal and violent?
Yeah, they are for sure. And, you know, I think every genre really has its own version of gore. In science fiction, that gore is going to be circuitry or gadgetry or something. And in realistic fiction, that gore is going to be psychological introspection or something like that. And yeah, in the slasher, it's definitely viscera and gore. And I think in horror in general, the way gore works is it is like a little trampoline you step on that launches the reader into a horror space. They know that, oh, I saw those glistening intestines and I must be in a place that anything can happen in. And that's where you want the reader in horror. You want them to be in a dark room where you've just blown the candle out and they don't know where the walls are. And gore is really good at delivering the reader to that, I think. I'm not saying horror stories have to have gore. A lot of them don't, and they're wonderfully effective. The slasher, in my estimation, is one of the subgenres of horror that does lean on gore a lot. And so, yeah, I had to do a lot of it in this Indian Lake trilogy, and I was happy to. Even with Don't Fear the Reaper, when I turned it into my editor, he said, I like it, but can you make it more gross, please? You know, and that was really fun.
Well, do you think there are certain issues or topics that horror writing or even slasher writing is best suited to address in other types of fiction?
I do. I think, well, the slasher is basically a justice fantasy. And that's why Jade subscribes to it so completely, is she needs justice in her life. So all of us now who are reading and watching slashers, and I do think slashers are having, if not a renaissance, a definite period of higher interest. I think it's because we watch the news and we see people at podiums and microphones saying and doing terrible things, and then they walk off, they shrug, they don't have any consequences. And that lack of fairness that we experience on a daily basis primes us for justice. And so then our media providing justice fantasies is really good. I think it tells us that there is a possibility that the world can be fair. And that's what the slasher is. The slasher, it's a bad place to be. It's a hard world to survive, but it is fair, finally.
Now, you reference, like you said, Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street. What are some of the new slashers that you're a fan of?
Oh, man, I just now watched The Camp Host, which I was completely impressed by. It's a really fun slasher. The big ones from the recent few years, let's say Freaky, Happy Death Day, Totally Killer, It Follows. That's going all the way back to 2014, I think it is. Before that, I think Cabin in the Woods in, what was that, 2010 or so, 2011? That is just a transformative, huge hinge point for the slasher. And before that, Tucker and Dale. That we've been on a really interesting trend this last decade or decade and a half, where slashers have been innovating on the fundamental formula and coming up with wonderful new variations that are able to access the same feelings but do it with different dynamics. And that has revitalized the slasher, as far as I'm concerned.
Are you a big fan of Stephen King?
I am.
He lives there in Boulder, right?
Well, I mean, he used to. In the 70s, he lived in Boulder. Actually, one of my students said they saw him at a bookstore in Boulder about 5 weeks ago. But I've never met Stephen King. It was an honor to have him on the audiobook for The Angel of Indian Lake. That's the highest honor I can even imagine. And I've been reading the guy since 1988, since Tommyknockers. I love his books, and I kind of like just what a good literary citizen he is. But no, I don't know him. Although I have a friend here who, like, somehow he knows the house that Stephen King used to live in when he was in Boulder in the 70s, and so he has Stephen King as a contact in his phone with that old address. It's all fake and just for fun, you know. Oh, but there is, you know, I'm always mountain biking and biking all over town, running errands. Last time Stephen King was in town to do a book event, it was for Dr. Sleep. And he spoke up at Chautauqua, this place up on the mountain, where the characters from The Stand had gathered temporarily, which was really kind of magical. And Stephen King told a story about walking across a certain bridge, hearing his cowboy boots echo on that bridge, and thinking, what if there was a troll under there? And then thinking, what if that troll was a clown? You know, and that's kind of where it comes from. And I bike across that bridge quite a lot, and the boards are still kind of loose on the bridge, and so I hear a lot of noise, a lot of clattering under that bridge when I'm going over it, and it kind of just magics up my ride, you know?
Yeah, I'll bet. One thing I think is really cool about Stephen King, too, is his wife, her maiden name is Spruce. Her name's Tabitha, or her maiden name was Tabitha Spruce. I've always gotten a kick out of that, because Spruce isn't a real common name.
I have no idea.
Yeah, but I'm a pretty big fan of Stephen King and in that whole era there. He lives in Maine now, our producers are telling me, so just get that information out there. But at one time, he did live in Boulder, Colorado. Well, Stephen, we're going to take another break and come back. We're going to talk more about some of your upcoming projects and just a little bit more about your life and your teaching there at University of Colorado. So listeners, stay with us. If you'd like to talk to Stephen or if you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support for this program provided by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, the collective spirit and unifying voice of 35 tribal colleges and universities. For over 45 years, AHEC has worked to ensure that tribal sovereignty is recognized and respected, and that tribal colleges and universities are included in this nation's higher education system. Information on a tribal college or university near you at AIHEC.org.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We are talking with Native horror author Stephen Graham Jones today, and there's still time to join this conversation. If you are a fan of his Hidden Lake trilogy or the character Jay Daniels, give us a call. We'd love to hear your perspective today. We're at 1-800-996-2848. And Stephen, I need to ask you here, interested listeners want to know, any chance we'll see Jay Daniels on the big screen, movie theaters, television, anytime soon?
You know, ever since Chainsaw came out, it's been getting optioned, and people are trying to turn it into either a television series or a feature. And right now, there's something else cooking. I can't say any names or particulars, but there's someone who can do it, and they're currently trying to do it, and I'm excited for it to maybe happen. Who knows?
Okay.
You never know with Hollywood projects. I found that as a novelist, what I can do best is, you know, give them the nod of approval and just keep writing new books and see what happens.
Well, I couldn't help but think that Lily Gladstone would just be perfect as casting for Jade. I mean, physically, just her personality, everything. So I don't know if that's on anybody's radar, but I would definitely think that might work.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Yeah, I know Lily a bit, and she's just an amazing person and actress. It'd be an honor to work with her in any capacity.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Stephen, for people who haven't read the trilogy yet and they're just going to get started, maybe they're listening to the show now and they say, hey, I'm going to go check this out. I'm going to get this book here and start reading. What films do you think would be helpful for them to watch just to get a little bit better understanding of how the story works and how these movies and horror films are kind of woven into the plot?
Yeah, I would say start with Scream and definitely hit Black Christmas, Halloween, Friday the 13th, and Nightmare on Elm Street. I think with those, what is that, probably 5 or 6 films, you would have a really good foundation to understand a lot of what's going on in the Indian Lake trilogy.
And that old cut you mentioned, Trilogy of Terror, do you think people can get away not watching that one with Karen Black?
Oh, I guess you can always get away with not watching it, but it's all kinds of fun too. I remember that Trilogy of Terror seems to have scarred the sleep of a whole generation, pretty much, and maybe 2 generations.
I was like in second grade when that came out. I remember it was on TV, and there was that little guy, and he was sawing his way out of the suitcase. And Does any of this stuff ever give you nightmares, Stephen? Do you ever like just get kind of freaked out by your own stories and your own writing?
I do. If I'm not getting freaked out by what I'm writing, then I quit writing it. If it's not scaring me, then I think it must not be real. The only way that I can write about something is if I invest in it intellectually and emotionally enough for it to become real to me, such that I can make it real on the page. So I do get scared, yes. And people always say, how do you write so fast? And it's not that I have extra time or I type particularly quick, any of that. It's that when I am writing a novel, I lose the dividing line between what's real and what's not real. And so I therefore have to run really, really fast to get to the light at the end of this long tunnel so I can get back to the real world and know that I'm not going to see my characters down at the 7-Eleven or somewhere.
Do you ever have Native people say, Stephen, you should be careful writing about some of these themes, from a Native perspective? You never know. You want to be careful. Do you ever have people kind of make spiritual references like that to you?
A little bit, but my kind of guiding philosophy, I guess you could call it, has always been that if you're making the elders nervous, then you're doing the right thing. I think that we can't just keep doing the same thing over and over. Like, ceremony has to change. You can't lock in a ceremony 300 years ago and expect it to work on the modern world. That's why Leslie Silco has that medicine man in ceremony using phone books and stuff in his ceremony, I think. I mean, I don't want to lay stuff on Silco that she wouldn't really want, but that's what I get from that read. And yeah, so I think if you're not broaching into a little bit dangerous territory, then are you really writing? And I want to really write.
Well, let's talk about some of your upcoming work. You've got another book that's going to be released pretty soon. Tell us a little bit about I Was a Teenage Slasher.
Yeah, that comes out in middle of July. I Was a Teenage Slasher. It's set in 1989. The protagonist is this guy named Tolly Driver, who is 17. I was 17 in 1989 as well, so it's a world that I'm familiar with. And it's set in La Mesa, Texas, which is in West Texas, a little town, another little town. Prairie Farm was a little town, so is La Mesa. And I did a lot of growing up in La Mesa. I grew up 45, 50 miles from there, so I was always in West Texas. You always go to the next town over to do whatever, And it was really, I don't know what the word is. It's really like nostalgic for me to go back there, I guess. And it felt really good to put my feet on the ground in 1989 and also to have brought a slasher.
What about non-slasher fiction? Is that an interest you have as well?
Definitely. Within horror, I've done Haunted House. I've done a lot of zombie books, I guess. I love all the subgenres of horror. I just love everything that's under the horror umbrella, but I've gone wider than that too. I've done science fiction novel, I've done crime novels, I've done thriller novels, I've done literary novels, I've done novels that are so weird that people don't know what to call them. And I'll keep doing that. It's just these last few years, I have been really interested in plumbing the depths of the slasher and just seeing what big fish I can pull up from those deep, deep waters. And I think with I Was a Teenage Slasher, that might be the last slasher I do for a little bit, anyways. I've got 2 or 3 more swirling around in my head, but I've also got a vampire novel I've written that'll be coming out soon. And I've got another time travel novel that'll be coming out before too long. So I'll be doing other things for a while, but I'll always be thinking about the slasher. I think that'll always be my favorite little corner of horror.
Well, all these projects just sound really, really exciting. And Stephen, in addition to you writing all these novels, you're also an English professor at the University of Colorado there in Boulder. Tell us a little bit about what it's like for you teaching English. And I want to ask you also, do you require your students to read some of your books?
No, I don't require them to read my stuff. That would be weird to me to like give them quizzes on, was this a good novel or something? That would be quite awkward. I'd probably give them higher points for saying, no, it wasn't a good novel. So no, I don't expect them to have read or to be reading my stuff, but I like teaching a whole lot. I teach probably 2/3 fiction workshops at both the advanced undergraduate and the graduate level. And those are a blast, of course. I think my advanced undergrads have to write a novel. My intermediate undergrads have to write a novella, and they have to do that in addition to all the other stories they have to turn in over the course of the semester. But at the graduate level, I teach workshops, of course, how to write fiction, but I also teach literature. And lately I've taught found footage fiction. I've taught The Vampire. I've taught Haunted House. I've taught the Western. Here in the fall, I'm teaching the possession narrative. And these are all research for me for novels I want to write, basically. I don't necessarily have a clear idea or a premise of what I want to do, but in the course of teaching this course, I want to understand the genre in a really engaging fashion. And the students are so capable and smart and so willing to go into these spaces with me that I just learn and learn and learn. And that's my favorite thing about teaching, I think, is learning. I'm just one of those people who is a constant student. I think I never left campus, and I always want to be in classrooms learning.
What do you learn from your students? I imagine you probably have a lot of 19, 20-year-old students, Gen Ys. What do they tell you?
Oh, well, I mean, I guess the youngest I see him is probably about 22 or so with the intermediates, maybe 21. But they have, like, with the students who are just starting out writing, it's really fun because they don't necessarily know what they can't do. And so they will try things on the page that I've become kind of too jaded over the course of all my writing instruction that I've received and all the experience I've had, that I consider certain things, if not illegal, then probably not a good idea anyways, but they don't know that yet. And so they will try it, and sometimes they pull it off. And it just reminds me continually that fiction is forever blooming and opening and becoming something else and finding new ways to engage the world, as it should, you know? So it's a younger set that's keeping fiction vital, I think.
And do you have a lot of native students who sign up for your courses?
I don't have a lot, no. I mean, CU Boulder, we do now have the Center for Native American Indigenous Studies, which is growing and growing. We are getting a population of Native students, but I haven't had a lot of them show up in my classes. And I think it's because a lot of these students are not English majors, and you have to be an English major to get in my class, basically.
Now, you mentioned you like to mountain bike, and what are some of your other hobbies? And tell us a little bit more about your family. I know you talked about your daughter earlier.
Yeah, I've got two kids, 24 and 21. I've been married to my wife now for, I guess, 29 years, maybe. We've been together since we were 19. We met freshman year of college. And other hobbies, yeah, mountain biking is the main thing. I used to be really big into basketball, but I finally started getting enough surgeries and injuries that I decided that all these recovery periods are taken away from the work I can do on the page. So I had to swear off basketball. Then I went to hacky sack, which I love hacky sack. That got me through high school pretty much. But then I hurt myself playing hacky sack. You know, I don't have the joints for it. I don't have the knee joints and ankle joints to do hacky sack in a good way anymore. So I had to give up hacky sack. And then I went to playing pool, and I love playing pool. I can play pool for hours and hours. But my shoulders have started to go pretty bad. Right now I've got my shoulders all bandaged up. I just got some ultrasound guided cortisone steroids shoved into them, which was quite a grueling experience, but it's making them a little bit better. I still hope to get back to playing pool, but right now it's mostly mountain biking and, of course, reading. I read comic books and novels and nonfiction compulsively, listen to a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of audiobooks. I used to be into building old trucks. One of my favorite places to be in the world is a junkyard, a pull your own parts junkyard. Mm-hmm. I've tried to get away from that because one of my neighbors was threatening legal action because I was turning the neighborhood into a junkyard with all the old vehicles I was hauling home. So, So I had to sell my old trucks, and so I'm trying to resist that urge to go to the junkyard and do stuff.
Yeah, I imagine Boulder, Colorado isn't really the place you want to have old engines and transmissions out in your front yard, right?
That's what I always considered like success. Like everybody in my family, I always know that they've made it when they have like a junkyard in their front yard,
Yeah, all that Indian wealth, right? All those old rides out there parked. Stephen, well, geez, I mean, a hacky sack is too physically taxing. Shooting pools too physically taxing. What about video games? Do you play any of those slasher video games?
I've never got into video gaming. The last video game I actually engaged was Galaga, dropping quarters at the arcade. But I've never gotten into console or computer video games. I should. I know that I really feel like video games and film and television and fiction are all braiding together and kind of hybridizing. I think they're going to produce something new that will be able to really effectively engage with the world. I worry that because I don't game, I might be left behind on a train station just waving to everybody who's leaving while I'm standing here holding all my paper books that are becoming antiques, But like Stephen King says, the book is a wonderful technology. You can drop it in the bathtub, you can leave it on the porch, and it's going to be there for you when you open it again. There's no denying how wonderful and elegant that is.
Well, I've heard people say that for these younger generations, like you and I, we grew up with movies as being, like the big form of entertainment or television shows. And for a lot of them, it's like video games, and they connect more like with video game titles as we do, like with old movie titles. Stephen, we got a couple more minutes. We still got more to talk about. You did a series of graphic novels. Tell us about that experience and if we can maybe see more graphic novels or comic books in your future.
Yeah, I've done a few. I've done My Hero of the Memorial Ride, and most recently I've done Earth Divers, a series, ongoing series with IDW, the comic book house. It's set in 2112 in the Southwest, and by 2112 the ecosphere has collapsed. All the rich people are leaving Earth to go pollute somewhere else, and the Indians have been left behind. These four people, they find a time travel cave, and they use it to try to go back in time to kill Columbus to stop America from happening, because they think America, they diagnose that America is responsible for the ecosphere collapsing. So by killing America, they can save the world. And it's been really fun to go back and fight Columbus and fight the founding fathers in 1776. It's been so, it's like wish fulfillment, And as for upcoming comic books, yeah, I have True Believers that's coming out momentarily. I guess I said I wasn't going to do any more trilogies, but it's a trilogy. It's a 3-issue limited series.
And the
It's a
illustrators you
slasher
work,
series.
tell us about
Excuse me?
the illustrators you work with. Tell us about those
Oh
folks.
man, Davide Gianfelice, he's an Italian guy on Earth Divers, and he just kills it. He's one of those artists who can make every panel dynamic and then do the layout of the page dynamic. The layout becomes dynamic in itself, but where Davide really, really shines is on his two-page spreads. I think because he is so good at crossing the fold with his art that I've probably written more two-page spreads for Earth Divers than I initially planned. But you've got to write to the talents and the specific capabilities of who you're working with as an artist, and that is something that Davide is really, really competent with.
Well, Stephen, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation. But again, I'm just so grateful for you coming on the show today to talk about The Angel of Indian Lake and all of your other work. And please just keep writing and keep giving us these great stories, okay?
Man, thank you for reading them. It's been great talking with you. Thank you.
You bet. Absolutely. Well, listeners, we are going to wrap up the conversation now. So thank you again for listening to our show. And we'll be back again tomorrow with a look back at the 1964 Great Alaska Earthquake. Until then, I'm your host, Sean Spruce.
Does your club, institution, or other group need custom branded apparel? A wide variety of t-shirts, hoodies, and much more, all custom printed or embroidered, are available from nativescreenprinting.com, a division of Skyscreen Printing, who support this program.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnia.
OCO, celebrate National Nutrition Month. Choose healthier food options for you and your loved ones. Sometimes it can be difficult to make good food choices, but there are many resources that can help. For more information, visit ihs.gov/diabetes or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.